people having their first idea, they try it out, they learn a lot, and then they actually have to change it. And it's often on that second change when they kind of go, right, I'm going to try and do something like change this a bit, that things can actually take off.
I think what you said is really important, because you did at a point when, like you said, you were relatively successful, you know, 2 million revenue and profitable is a dream for a lot of companies in an early stage. So to take that decision that far on is very, very bold, because, you know, there'll be startup founders there right now who are sat there thinking, what do I do? You know, markets can change, I'm not going to be able to raise money as easy as possible. So I think that advice is really, really important. Today we're joined by a good friend of mine, Henry Dezoot, who is the founder of Look After My Bills and an angel investor across over 80 companies, is it now?
Yep.
Phenomenal. Looking forward to speaking about your journey and everything you've been up to in the last couple of years. Do you think you were always an entrepreneur, was always this path for you, or did you feel like you've kind of fell into the entrepreneurial lifestyle?
No, I don't think I can pretend that I've like always been entrepreneurial. In fact, my kind of first career, I started out in kind of think tanks and doing policy work, and then and a bit of communications, and then I ended up working in government as an advisor. I always knew I wanted to do something for myself, and I think, you know, I loved working in government. I was very lucky to do that, but I realized the buck didn't stop with me. So when I left, I was kind of like, you know, I had options to kind of do other jobs and things, and I said, actually, do you know what, I want to do a startup, because I wanted to experience that of like actually the buck stopping with me, like feeling that full responsibility and trying to bring something into existence. You know, I'm not one of those people who's like, since the age of 15, have been selling things on eBay and sweets to the kids in schools or whatever, like in like my classmates. I wasn't one of those people, so I don't want to pretend I was. But I always wanted to do something of my own.
I always find it interesting when people who have that kind of trader mentality then go into business, because it kind of mirrors their youth a little bit. And I guess what you get when you get entrepreneurs who have a bit more life experience, they look at kind of bigger problems, I guess, because they've experienced more than being that person that buys and sells. So when it came to kind of like thinking of what startup you're going to do, did you go with the first idea?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think we did, in the sense that, so I was very lucky to set it up with a very old friend of mine from university. Mm-hmm. And he'd done a startup before. The idea was kind of the big deal. So it was kind of collective bargaining for consumers, trying to bring people together and get them deals they couldn't get on their own on kind of cost of living stuff. And that was the first thing we did. And the truth was, is it didn't really work brilliantly well. Mm-hmm. It kind of went well, and we made a bit of money and a bit of profit, but it never really felt like it was going to take off. And we did some good things, like largest mass switch to green energy. I think this happens to a lot of good businesses, which is why I'm quite pro people pivot. I hate the word pivot, but like in terms of like people having their first idea, they try it out, they learn a lot, and then they actually have to change it. And it's often on that second change when they kind of go, right, I'm going to try and do something like change this a bit, that things can actually take off. We pivoted it way too late, actually, but that was when it started to take off, and we kind of changed the idea and moved forward.
Yeah, and in those discussions, you know, how important was it to be kind of open-minded to what the feedback was coming? Because, you know, we see a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of people who kind of, you know, come up with an ideology of a vision that they want to achieve. And reality is, you know, as you say, the feedback from consumers might not be that's the kind of need. How important was it to be open-minded in those periods?
Well, I mean, it's the most important thing. And I think like all founders need to, like, you know, that kind of regular cadence of speaking to your customers and getting feedback is like super important. And we, I mean, the brutal truth is that we kind of knew we needed to change after maybe like 2 years and didn't actually do it until year four. It was a tricky one because we were making money. We were, you know, doing a couple million quid of revenue a year. So it was quite difficult to then kind of be like, right, well, we're going to blow up the whole thing and kind of totally start again and do a completely different thing. We kind of knew it, and the customers were telling us, and the feedback from the users was, you know, we don't want one-off deals. We want a service that carries on forever. And that was the idea of where Look After My Bills came from, was that automated service that keeps you on the best deal every year. But it just took us a while to get there, because it's not easy. And you know, and I do regret a little bit of that, because I think we could have gone a couple of years
earlier. Did you have like shareholders to manage at that point?
Yeah, we certainly did.
Yeah. So was that playing on your mind as kind of, you know, you've sold them one thing and reality is you're going to have to execute something else? Was that kind of something that was stopping you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, and also, you know, and like for the shareholders, they kind of were seeing like, you know, they're seeing decent growth. You know, we'd got to 2 million quid a year. They were like, well, this is like, you know, that's not nothing, and you've done well, and that's the hardest bit. You just need to kind of keep going. Whereas we were going, yeah, well, we do want to keep going, but we want to throw all of this down the toilet and we want to flip to something else completely. And we knew that conversation was going to be tricky. Mm-hmm. We knew it was the right thing to do. And, you know, history showed, you know, what happened shows that that was the right thing to do and set up Look After My Bills. But there's one key moment, actually, that made it forced us to do it. We applied to Y Combinator, the startup accelerator out in California, and we applied with the new business, so with Look After My Bills.
Yep.
And by some sort of miracle, we managed to get in.
Yeah, because it isn't like 0.01 acceptance rate.
Yeah, it's pretty tricky.
Yeah.
So we got incredibly lucky. We applied very late, so we applied like in like December, and it started in January. And we got kind of a last minute interview, and suddenly like 3 weeks later, they were like, right, you're in. And we were flying out to California in January. Well, so they do this, they used to do this thing where they would fly you out for an interview. So they flew us out for an interview in December, and the interview is 10 minutes long, and then they fly you back. I mean, it was absolutely an incredible experience. They don't do that anymore now after
Zoom.
Exactly. But we were basically like starting in January, and we were still running the business, the previous business, in the sense of the big deal. We'd done a big like switch with the big deal in November and December. So we suddenly it was like, okay, we actually need to now like properly like move the whole thing, launch it. And I think one of the things Y Combinator is very helpful at is that it's a very short 3-month program, and you stand up in front of investors at the end of like March or April, and you have to do your pitch, and you have to like grow as quickly as you possibly can in that 3 months up to that thing, up to that demo day, as it were. And you have to get the graph to go like that, and be like a kind of as vertical as possible. And that really does make you think like, okay, we stop messing about now, let's properly go for it.
I've got a friend on at the moment, and he's telling me exactly the same. You know, I think what, they're about a month, two now.
Yep.
So yeah, don't hear from him often anymore.
Yeah, I think that's it. And yeah, and I've worked, like some of my angel investments have done it recently. There's one in this batch as well. You kind of warn them, you're like, okay, it's going to be pretty full on. But no one really realizes until you get there, like how full on it is.
Because you were 2018, were you?
Yeah, 2018.
How many English companies have been on before you?
Oh, I think, well, I mean, probably the most like famous English company was Songkick, which was Ian Hogarth's company. And I think there've been a kind of few other ones. And there was a few in our batch, and actually still good. It's like Friends was some of the ones that were in our batch, which was great. And one of the crazy things that Y Combinator does, and I don't know if your friends who's doing it now or this, but they make you download a Chrome extension, which is like just a countdown to your demo day.
That's cool.
And it's just on your, you know, so just whenever you open your laptop, there's just a countdown. And you're just like, oh my God, okay.
We're in a period of time, a bit of a downturn, aren't we, for the first time. So I think a lot of founders are sat there scratching their heads a little bit. You know, do we carry on one way or do we go another way? So I think what you said is really important, because, you know, you've done it, you did it at a point when, like you said, you were relatively successful, you know, 2 million revenue and profitable is a dream for a lot of companies in early stage. So to take that decision that far on, it's very, very bold, because, you know, there'll be startup founders there right now who are sat there thinking, what do I do? You know, market's going to change. I'm not going to be able to raise money as easy as possible. So I think that advice is really, really important. So you've done the famous pivot, and then you get opportunity to go on Dragon's Den. How did you approach it, and what was kind of your strategy going on to it? Were you looking for specific Dragon, or were you kind of looking at this as a PR opportunity?
So Will, my brilliant co-founder, and I had been chatting about it for a while, and we never really had kind of got round to applying. And it just happened that on literally one Sunday, I was at home watching Dragon's Den, and I was just like, this is ridiculous. We should just apply. So I downloaded the form and I filled it in, and I just chucked it straight in. And I just messaged Will and said, I've applied for Dragon's Den. Nothing will probably happen. Don't worry, you know, like worry about it. He was actually, at that point, he was in California raising money. Because I my first child turned up 2 weeks before demo day, so I couldn't do the...
Turned up, like you said, it was unexpected. No. That sounds like it was unexpected.
No, it was due and came at the... So I flew back from California to do all of that. So left my poor co-founder to raise all raise the money out there, which he did a brilliant job at. We chucked it in, and I kind of just like thought nothing of it. And then we got calls from the production people, and they were like, well, can you come in for a chat? And so... We did all of that, and we're very lucky to kind of get on the show. We were also very lucky because we had just raised money at a certain valuation after Y Combinator from some great US investors. And so when we went into the den, we knew that we had a kind of like base level of valuation that we just couldn't go under.
So it felt more like a round extension rather than an individual raise.
Exactly. And actually, as it turned out, the dragons invested it on kind of like on the same terms as the ones that we did. So when we walked into the den, we and thanks to Will, who did a lot of hard work on this, we kind of like plotted out a strategy of kind of like, well, we'll start at this level. And if we get any offers, we'll then drop down to this level. Mm-hmm. And then if we get any other offers, we'll drop down to this level. Because you've got to always, you know, they've got to feel like they're getting a deal and they're negotiating. Yep. And so we kind of had a plan for how we were going to do it. We started very high, had a drop down, and then another drop down. And actually, I mean, it was all cut down to 12 minutes, but they were filming for nearly 3 hours. Mm. And we ended up going to the wall 3 times.
Really?
The first set of offers where all the dragons offered, we went to the wall, came back with our counter offer. They then all offered again. We went to the wall, came back with our counter offer, and then they started peeling off. And we ended up with Jenny and Tej, who made the kind of final offer. And then we went back to the wall to kind of discuss it. And I remember there was a point when, and I didn't show this on TV, but there was a point where we were like, here's the reason why we can't go below this valuation. Because we've just raised off these people in America, and it's just not fair to do that to them. And I remember Peter Jones saying, I really like that because it shows that you would protect me as a shareholder. Mm. So we were worried that everybody would be like, kind of like, no, that's terrible. And, you know, we're better than them. And we should get a better valuation. But actually, they all kind of took it in a much better way. We got very lucky, but there was a kind of strategy with it, which was mainly my co-founder's brilliant work. So I was just kind of like
a bit of baby brain still as well.
Yeah, totally. Like, absolutely. Like, incredibly nervous. But he was just rock. He was an absolute rock. And if you watch the footage, you can see him being very calm and me slightly shaking around.
So what impact did it have on from the platform and users? Was it a big kind of PR spin for you, and did it really have a big impact on the business?
It did. And, you know, we were very lucky because we negotiated quite hard, we actually ended up getting the best deal in the history of the day.
Yep. Valuation-wise.
Yeah. So on the night, it was like obviously huge, and lots of people came and hit the website. But actually, what the most interesting thing about it was that a lot of our marketing channels that we had been kind of slightly struggling to scale before, from Google to Facebook or whatever, the kind of cost per acquisition just suddenly dropped. Mm. And I think that was a combination of like the brand halo of having done Dragon's Den.
Yep.
It was also our ability to do kind of Dragon's Den focused. You know, we were literally able to say in our ads, we got the best deal in the history of the show. And yep. Jenny Campbell and Tej Lavani, who were our brilliant dragons, came into the office and met all the team, and that was like a huge kind of morale boost for everybody. And we took photos with them, and ended up using them in our ads. And then we were just able to, like, our paid marketing was suddenly able to go much faster and much quicker. That was the real benefit of it. And you know, there were ads that were still working about Dragon's Den like a year, 2 years after we'd been on the show.
And then, you know, the business and yourself, you get ready for exit. How did that mentality kind of come about? Was it something you were always looking for, or was it, you know, I've been in your shoes, is it a case of, you know, how I felt like maybe the time is right now?
I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, Don, but my instinct with all this stuff is that businesses aren't sold, they're bought. And then when someone wants to buy you, that's when it actually happens. When you kind of want to sell, doesn't really, you know, like, it's all well and good you wanted to sell, but, and it was a slightly funny one in the sense that, we'd had quite a lot of interest in us. You know, we went from zero to 150,000 customers in 18 months. We had grown fast. And there was a lot of people who were just kind of like sniffing around, you know. And it wasn't until kind of Go Compare were like very, very serious that we thought actually this was actually going to happen. And it was also a very, very tough decision because we were at that point where we were growing fast. You know, things were going well. And it was like, well, we either have to go do a big... We'd raise less than $1 million in total in the whole time that we were running the business. And it was, well, do we go and try and do a big Series A? Not guaranteed we would have been able to raise that money, who knows? And we'd had some interest, you know, there was definitely some interest in it. Or we had an opportunity to sell at that point. And it was a very, very tough decision. I mean, I've got young kids, so there was definitely a factor in it. I think one of the interesting things was that some people just thought it was like an overnight success in the sense that we'd only launched Look After My Bills in 2018 and we sold in 2019. Mm. But the truth for me and my co-founder was that we'd been doing it since 2014. So, you know, and had 4 years of quite a, you know, tough journey, not taking salaries for the first year or two, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So it was a longer journey than that. And so it did feel right to sell at that point. Also, Go Compare, who bought us, you know, were very good. Like, they were like, we want to grow you very fast. We want to keep your brand. We're not going to get rid of the Look After My Bills brand. And so when we joined and I sold, I was spending 20 million quid a year on digital marketing and TV ads. At one point, we were spending 50 grand a day on Facebook. So it was fun. And I don't think I would have been able to do that with our own money.
Yep.
And we went from 150,000 customers to 750,000 customers in the next 18 months. There was a lot of good things about going for it, but it's always incredibly hard. I mean, you know, this, like selling your, you know, saying goodbye to your baby, you know, you do not run it, you know, that is, it's hard. Like, that's hard.
And in that process, how important was the fact that it felt like the right home for the business?
It was you know, the organization that understood us in the sense that we felt like we were the next generation of comparison sites. It was like, there's comparison sites where you do all the comparing, and the idea of Look After My Bills was that you don't have to do the comparing. We'll just find you the deals and we'll get you them. And so it felt like a very natural home. But also the team, you know, we spent a lot of time with the CEO and the CTO of Go Compare and the CMO, and it was kind of reassuring on all of those fronts. And they really did treat us very, very well. Mm. And I remember, so we had an earnout with it. And I remember the CEO saying at the end of the earnout how it's quite rare for an earnout for both parties to be very pleased.
Yep.
Because often things will break down and people will get confused by stuff. But we delivered them loads of customers. We got an earnout for that. And they were very happy about all of that. Mm-hmm. And so that actually worked out, you know, very well.
You're now in a situation where, you know, alongside the day jobs, you've got an active portfolio of angel investments. What do you look for in those kind of early stage companies? Because sometimes, you know, the technology or the business model is far too early to be able to say, yes, this is successful. But what is an angel are you looking for?
It's not easy because I'm investing at kind of pre-seed or seed. As you say, like you say, that is like, you know, fundamentally, it's a bet on people. What I try and do is spend a little bit of time with someone and see what they're like and how they act. Their kind of track record in terms of what other things they've done. But the number one thing I kind of optimize for is productivity.
You set the clock for them?
Well, I mean, I don't tell them I'm doing this, but what I'll often do is I will meet someone, talk to them about what they're doing, and then I'll be, okay, great, well, I'd love to have another call in a week or 2 weeks. And then I'll be like, okay, well, what have you managed to do? What have you done in the last 2 weeks? Mm-hmm. Now, if they're in like a kind of darkest depths of fundraising, it'll be like, well, where's the progress on fundraising? Mm-hmm. But I don't optimize, and I'm not like that interested in that. But what I want to see is like, we built this feature, or we built this thing, we've tested it and it didn't work, and we're changing to this, or we found this new channel, or we're trying to speak to this new client. Like, you know, the truth about the startup stuff is that it is a kind of like, you know, very tough journey, particularly at the start. And what I've noticed is that the founders who achieving things week on week, even if they're only small things, and they're testing things and drawing conclusions and then working out problems, are the ones that seem to do better. And it's also something from that actually Y Combinator taught me, was that in Y Combinator, what you do is you get put in a group of other startups, like a small group of like 8 startups, like a little founders group. And each week you sit down with them, with a Y Combinator partner, and you talk about the problems that you've been dealing with that week. And then you all brainstorm together the solutions. And each week, what you're meant to do is like come back and see where you've got to and what other problems you're dealing with or what it might be. And I remember a Y Combinator partner saying to me, I normally can tell which are the best startups because they'll have a problem 1 week, they'll come back the next week having solved it, and they've got a new problem they want to discuss with everybody. So, I mean, I feel very fortunate that people took a gamble on me in 2014. You know, I hadn't done anything like business-wise at all, and I was very lucky to have investors. And I feel strongly that I wanted to take chances on people now. And I think one of the things about kind of venture capital angel ecosystem in the UK is that we're just a bit behind the US and particularly the West Coast, certainly in terms of angels. You know, one of the things I definitely found useful was like the founder to founder relationship. I think like the angels who have been founders themselves and have gone through it understand what it's like to kind of go through that journey and also understand what it's like to have investors, some of whom are good and some of whom are bad. You know, I was very lucky that five angels that helped me in 2014 were all superb. But then some of the later investors weren't necessarily particularly helpful. Some of them actively unhelpful. And I think founders understand that because they've had to deal with that. Mm. And therefore, they kind of know what's good and what's bad. Yeah. And therefore, they can invest in the way that's right, which is, for me, it's like founders I'm lucky enough to have invested in understand that I'm there for them if they want help in any sort of way. And some of them I chat to every week, and some of them I'm on WhatsApp with, and we chat every day, and some of them I only, you know, I get emails and that's it. It's totally up to what they want. But the point being that I will never say to them, you need to do X or you need to do Y. It's kind of like trying to help them and be there for them, rather than kind of like telling them what they should be doing or how they should be doing it. Because even though I was lucky enough to be a founder, I don't know. I'm not close enough to their business, but I can just try and be supportive if I can.
Exactly. There's so many things that are transferable from business to business, but ultimately the founder will know the model, will know the customers, and will know that there's the hard metrics you can look at, but there's the kind of, you said there, it's the intrinsic feeling of when you were in the first business before you pivoted. You're saying, this doesn't feel right. You know, this isn't what's going to be able to scale. We need to do something about it. And that feeling only comes from those individuals who are literally at the coalface every single day, getting the kind of feedback from across tons of data points.
Totally. I think that's exactly right.
Obviously, we're the Summit podcast, so we talk to people about kind of, you know, what Summit there is they're working towards. What do you think of the term Summit when I ask you kind of what is your Summit, and do you think you've made it, or do you think you're still working towards something?
Dom, it's I don't know how you would define Summit. I mean, I definitely think that there's like more things for me to do in my career, and I've been very lucky to be able to have, you know, have a career in kind of government stuff and then also do a startup, and I feel like there's something out, you know, something else there.
Is it a startup?
It might well be. I think I might struggle to work for other people in the sense that, like, you know, once you've done it once, it's like, it's tricky. We're both laughing at each other.
It's very tricky.
Yeah, it is. So I think it's potentially another startup. I think the thing is though that it needs to be something that I really, really care about and I want, like, I feel really important about, because I've got young kids. I've got a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. You know how full on doing a startup is. It really is genuinely 24/7, particularly in the early days. And you do have to just do that to make something take off. Like, you've got to. For me to do that and then take time away, you know, I'm just loving being with my kids at the moment and being able to do school pickup and nursery run and all that kind of jazz. And to sacrifice that is got to be something very, very important. Mm. So I don't feel like I'm there yet. And I'm not quite sure what that will be. I mean, I think the real summit for me at the moment is, you know, is my kids, in the sense of like, you know, like, they provide new challenges every day.
Completely different challenges to business.
Definitely different challenges to business.
Which one's easier?
Business. And I mean, the big one is patience, right? Like, just the kind of like being at like, you know, at like having to kind of learn to just be super patient with them, which I don't always manage. But that's the real summit for me.
Yeah, we're finding patience with the kids.
Exactly.
Oh, thank you so much for speaking today. I really enjoyed the podcast, and thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. It's fantastic.
Thank you for listening to the Summit podcast by Fellows Adventures. Don't forget to like, comment, and share. And if you've got any recommendations of people you'd like us to speak to, let us know.